Hello, everybody, and welcome to another Spiritual Hollywood Hour. I am Kate Romero, your host, and I just want to give a bunch of gratitude over to Don Newsom and staff at BBS Radio for offering us this wonderful platform to raise consciousness using Hollywood. I have a great guest tonight by the name of Dr. Michael Lardon, who is a sports psychiatrist. He's written a book called Finding Your Zone. And finding your zone is sort of like falling in love, as we're going to find out. And you're going to want to hear this. The website for Dr. Lardon is www.drlardon.com. That's www.drlardon.com. That's drlardon.com. And I'm just going to give you a little bit of background on Dr. Lardon, whose name is Michael, and I will be calling him Michael, and I'll probably switch off from Dr. Michael Lardon to Dr. Lardon to maybe Mr. MD, and have a lot of fun. So Dr. Lardon's sport psychiatry career was first catalyzed by his involvement in table tennis, which really is exciting for me because I love ping pong, which is another name for table tennis, if I'm not mistaken. To me, it's like a cat chasing a mouse, and I love to catch that mouse. So in 1976, Michael Lardon was chosen by the United States Table Tennis Association as the country's most outstanding junior and sent to Japan to train with the world champion. After a career of playing professionally in Europe and Asia, he won a gold medal in the 1980 Olympic Sports Festival and subsequently retired from table tennis and focused on his academic career. After medical school, Dr. Lardon completed an internship in internal medicine at UCLA, and he completed a psychiatric residency and a subsequent fellowship in psychopharmacology and psychobiology at the University of California, San Diego. During this time, he worked with and caddied for his brother, Brad Lardon, in the finals of the PGA Tour qualifying school. Team Lardon's quest for a fully exempt tour card was successful, and his experience was chronicled in the New York Times bestseller, A Good Walk Spoiled, and Golf. Dr. Lardon is nationally recognized as a speaker and lectures on various topics, including the zone, peak performance, and overcoming mood disorders. His lectures focus on finding your zone and achieving peak performance in all domains of life with a specific interest in maximizing productivity in competitive business environments. Dr. Lardon is dedicated to educating the public about depression and anxiety disorders. Most recently, Dr. Lardon has worked on a destigmatizing depression campaign with Olympic skeleton champion Jim Shea in partnership with Wyeth Ayerst, I think. We're going to have to go over that name when I bring Dr. Lardon on. Dr. Lardon's lifelong goal is to help the general public conceptualize mental health to include not only the recognition and treatment of mental illness, but the maximization of human potential. Without further ado, I'd like to bring on Dr. Michael Lardon. Hello, Michael. Thank you for being here.
Hi, Kate. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, that was, it was, you've done so much, and it's so varied and vast that, you know, as I was reading a bit of your bio, I was so fascinated by it that I kept losing track. This is an amazing journey that you've been on in your lifetime, to start out at table tennis and being a champion and winning the award and going on to medical school and then having a residency in psychiatry and your love of sports and how you blend sports with spirituality is so fascinating to me. And, you know, sports could be the doorway to spirituality if you look at it a little bit different than most people watch a ball game or most people watch a golf tournament or a tennis match. I'd like to hear you, if you wouldn't mind, just start out, being this is Spiritual Hollywood. You can say anything if it's BBS Radio, then it's definitely not mainstream, and you can talk about spirituality all you want to on this show. And I'd like to know your thoughts and ideas on how spirituality can be brought forward through sports.
Well, I mean, for me, it really was a very organic process, and I think, as you mentioned a little bit in the bio, in 1976, I was in the finals of the United States Championship in Caesar's Palace, and to make a long story short, and this is in table tennis, of course, I had a peak performance moment or kind of a zone experience myself where normally in ping pong or table tennis at a high level, the ball moves at 100 miles an hour.
Wow.
And I was in this state of consciousness where the ball started to come in slow motion. And the next thing I knew, I was winning every point, and it was really like a very hypnotic state. Now, mm-hmm. what paradoxically happened was my coach at the time said to me, you know, this is one of the biggest upsets in professional table tennis, and ba-boom, I fell out of that zone-like state, didn't win the U.S. championships, didn't have my name on the rackets and all that, but that experience of being there and not being there really set the stage for the rest of my life, where now I work with the Olympic teams and I work with the PGA Tour and the NFL, and really helping athletes get to a higher state of consciousness. We don't use that word in professional sports, and it's fun to be on this radio show because in academia and medicine, we often stay away from the word consciousness, but really, that's what it's all about. And when you have a peak experience in sports, it certainly is a doorway into the spirit, just like a meditative experience. It's kind of one of those states where your ego that separates you from the world. We all have this ego and this perception of ourselves. But when that ego falls away and you become connected, you go into what we call a flow state, and you can almost experience things before they happen. And this has been chronicled by Michael Jordan and Magic Johnson and many, many high-profile athletes. And so I think sports is a wonderful way or a wonderful platform to help Western society at large learn the importance of creating that right mental state to help them in life.
Wow, that is, I never thought of sports in that way before, and I absolutely know what you're talking about. I never played ping pong before in my life until, gosh, it was 2003. And someone who won lots and lots of awards and trophies for ping pong took me out to a ping pong table. I was living at the Oakwood Apartments. They had a ping pong table. And I just started playing. And because I have very good hand-eye coordination, I think when we were at lunch with Dennis Waitley and John Steller and myself, we talked about how I came to have great hand-eye coordination, which is having a world title in arm wrestling. You really need to have that. And I remember asking you questions about what would compel a 120-pound woman to want to excel at that. And being that hand-eye coordination is very, very, very necessary for ping pong, and I already had that natural ability by living on a farm and doing all kinds of things that required that. That's where I got my training. It was just a natural thing for me to hit that ball. And within 15 minutes, I was doing something called slamming that I didn't know what that was, but I was slamming. And before the end of an hour, I was playing like I'd been playing, you know, for a year. And that's not to brag or anything. It's just interesting how when you become caught up in something that you can get your ego out of the way and you can perform at your peak level even if you don't know how to do that thing. Does this make any sense?
Well, it makes absolute sense. I mean, you know, lately Eckhart Tolle's new book and his older book, The Power of Now, have been, you know, big books and bestsellers and an Oprah. And really what he preaches is the same kind of concept that we try to teach athletes. We take Michael Phelps right now in the Olympics. He's gone on and he's won 8 gold medals, and that's more than anybody in any Olympics ever. And when you hear him interviewed or when you see him on the TV, you know, he's not looking at endorsement deals. He's just listening to his iPod, and he's doing the same thing that he's been doing all these years, staying very centered, very humble. And interestingly enough, when the team won, the swimming team, they interviewed all 4 of the swimmers. Michael Phelps you know, who is arguably the greatest swimmer of all time, was probably the most humble of the whole group.
Mm.
And there's a tremendous lesson to learn. And I think, you know, as society becomes westernized and we become more involved with our Blackberries and this digital world, we become less connected to really the spiritual world. And sports, you know, we don't really know why we all love watching the Olympics or the great competitions. We think it's because, you know, we can relate vicariously to the athletes, and that's certainly true. But I really think that it's even more than that. It's when an athlete has to embrace many of the things that we embrace in life, like fear and anxiety, and mobilize their courage. And it's almost as if when you pass through fear, you find the beauty that lies underneath.
Mm.
And you really become very connected. And so that's, that in a way is what we try to teach these athletes that are competing in the Olympics. We don't use words like consciousness too much because we don't want to scare them, but that's in fact exactly what we're doing to help them.
Right. So basically sports can be a doorway to higher consciousness, and for a lot of the population who really love sports, who aren't really, let's say, not so much not interested in higher consciousness, but it's just not in their awareness.
Right.
As a place to go or a place to aspire to.
Right.
Sports can be a way for them to reach a higher consciousness. And how does that affect a person watching a very intense game? It's like, I love the Lakers. I love the playoffs. I just love, love, love it. And if somebody is a spectator watching really wonderful, wonderful athletes perform at their best, can that impact the spectator as well as the people who are playing the game?
Well, I think absolutely. I think the spectator feels as if they're flowing in the game with, let's say, Magic Johnson or Kobe Bryant. And
and
it really reminds me of when I was young, I traveled extensively, and I can remember being in Chennai, India. Madras is another name for the city, Chennai. And I remember thinking that no matter where you were in the world, Cambodia, East Germany, there's always a picture of, back then it was Michael Jordan, now it's probably Tiger Woods. There's always some famous sports figure that everyone, you know, associates with. And in Western world, to try to teach the people the teachings of the Dalai Lama or meditative practices, in and of themselves is a real hard sell. It's a very
right.
difficult thing to do.
Right.
But if you can show the young people that, you know, Tiger Woods in fact does meditate, and these principles of spiritualism and mental discipline are the principles that great athletes use, and not only great athletes, great scientists, great musicians, and great artists, then you have the young people who say, you know, I want to be like Tiger Woods, or the old Gatorade ad, I want to be like Mike, meaning Michael Jordan.
Mm-hmm.
And really, that was my dream when I was young. I saw the power of sports being able to communicate this message to people regardless of race, religion, wherever they lived. Sports is a universal language. I love that the Olympics transcends, you know, political boundaries. And, you know, it's like for those 2 weeks, you know, let's try, although Russia and Georgia are having some problems now, but let's try to lay down our guns and lay down our differences and all be human beings and join in all these various sports in the Olympics.
Mm-hmm.
So that's really why I felt it personally growing up, and I saw how powerful it was, and I've had the very good fortune of working with some of the world's best athletes throughout my life, and that has been a way for me to, you know, teach people and affect change in others' lives.
I hear you, and I'm also looking at a quote of the month about you. It says, Dr. Lardon helped me to believe that no matter what happens, I have what it takes to overcome anything. As long as I live, I will never be able to repay him for that gift. That's Jimmy Shea, Olympic gold medalist. So you're impacting so many lives. It seems just really natural that you would have written the book, Finding Your Zone, 10 Core Lessons for Achieving Peak Performance in Sports and in Life. And I'll give your website again for people to check out your book. And, you know, they can order it from your website, correct?
Well, my website, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, all the major stores.
Great. It's www.drlardon.com. That's DRLARDON.com. And you'll probably get yourself into the zone just looking at his website. It's pretty fulfilling and lots to look at. I mean, like I said, just going over your bio and trying to find the best gold nuggets to talk about to introduce you, that was like a major feat for me, because everything is so interesting and there's so much, and you've just done so much to be such a young man.
Well, thank you, Kate. I'm probably not quite as young as you're making me out to be, but I'm sure my wife would appreciate that.
Yes, I saw you in person. You're very young. And actually, you're a new dad, aren't you?
I am. We just had, my wife and I, we had a 6-month, our daughter now is 6 months old, and,
uh-huh.
and we have a 4-year-old daughter, so that's really, that's a tremendous experience. And one of the things I talk about is, you know, getting in the zone or finding peak performance in life isn't something that we have to search for. It isn't something that we don't have. In fact, children, when they're playing, they're in the zone. They're completely immersed in the moment. It's almost as if when we're born from that place, and then it's all the noise of society. I kind of talk about our society being an ADD society, like an attention deficit disorder. And really, it's about trying to get centered and going back to, you know, that original mental state, like kids playing in the backyard, just having fun. And
right.
That's really when we do our best in life.
Right, because there's really nowhere to get, and you're not worried about competing. You're just enjoying, and you're just in the flow, in the zone.
Well, that's right. And the trick to competing is having fun.
Yes.
If you see it as this competition and you make it out to be more than what it is, then people get in trouble. I mean, often I'll work with a professional golfer who might have a putt for, let's say, even $100,000 if they make that putt.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things we try to explain to them, it's still just having fun, hitting a little ball in a cup. And I don't mean to be smart with them, but sometimes I'll say, you know, there's at least 5 billion people in the world that really don't even know that you're making this putt. So why don't you just relax, have some fun, and let's just go make it.
That's a great, great way to speak to somebody's ego.
Yeah.
And having fun, I know from experience, is the one ingredient that keeps fear and anxiety away.
Absolutely.
You cannot laugh and be anxious and fearful at the same time. Well, you can have a nervous laugh, but you really can't have an authentic belly laugh and feel nervous or anxious or fearful.
Right. Well, humor in fear or humor in anxiety, they're the antithesis of each other. And just mm-hmm. as you say, if you have a belly laugh, that's a great way to let anxiety go. And, you know, we've all heard the advice, when you're public speaking, just pretend everyone in the audience is naked, and that way you feel embarrassed for them, and then you relax.
Mm-hmm.
So there's really some truth to that. And, you know, kind of, you know, taking inventory of your mind and trying to clear your mind and learn some simple meditative techniques, you know, and they can be as simple as, you know, taking a beautiful walk and looking at the ocean. And just for 10 minutes a day, you know, letting the thoughts pass through your head and learning that the thoughts that you experience don't define you, just as the emotions you experience don't define you. An analogy I like to use is, imagine sitting in a cinema waiting for the movie to begin, and you see the commercials coming before the movie, the previews of other movies. You just sort of watch them waiting for the movie. And similarly, we try to get people to just watch their thoughts, not always attach to them, watch that emotion come in, watch it go out, kind of like waves, and then you find stillness. And when you find stillness, that's when you sort of tap into your greater power.
Right. That's something I myself have been working on in the last few weeks, is to stalk my thoughts. And when I get, you know, I have many, many different things that I do during my day. I've created 5 different businesses and I run them all myself, and I manage to get everything done every day. And I love it because it's on my terms, and everything I do is to make a difference in people's life. And it's, in the healing arts. And, you know, to be a talent manager, it requires a lot of know-how, and I've got almost 3 decades in that industry. So I've leveled off, and to me, it's so easy to do, because I've been doing it for so long. And the thing is that when I'm trying to take off one hat and put on another one, from, let's say, from being a talent manager to being a radio host, sometimes I feel like an ant on a Cheerio running around in circles looking for an exit ramp, and there is no exit ramp. So I just have taught myself recently, I don't need an exit ramp. I can just hop off. So what I've been doing lately is stalking my thoughts, finding out when I'm on that Cheerio, and just jumping off it. And I have probably 1,000 times more peace in my life. The energy I was spending on obsessing over something and not trying to figure it out and not knowing how to figure it out, the energy I'm conserving by not doing that is amazing. It gives me so much more freedom in my life and a lot more energy.
And probably more clarity.
A lot more clarity, because you can't be creative when you're anxious.
Right, right. And you know, we think of ourselves as having 5 senses, you know, touch, smelling, sound, taste, and hearing. But, of course, there's a 6th sense, and that's intuition.
Yes.
And even the most pragmatic scientists don't refute that intuition is a real phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
And when we're quiet, we start to tap into our intuitive knowledge. And I was fortunate enough in my undergraduate experience at Stanford University to have Jonas Salk, who was the inventor of the polio vaccine, be a professor.
Mm-hmm.
And he told us about his experience trying to solve the puzzle of the polio virus, which in his day and age was as certainly as formidable as AIDS and HIV.
Mm-hmm.
And what he talked about was how he would quiet his mind and even dream and take inventory of his dreams. And then in one particular night, while he dreamt, he had what's called a lucid dream. And a lucid dream is when you're aware that you're dreaming and you sort of can control the dream.
Mm.
He was able to control the dream and see a strategy to attack the virus, to eradicate the virus, and then the next day in the lab and in the ensuing weeks, that's when he found the discovery of the polio vaccine. And his point was that almost all great discoveries really don't come from analytic thought and crunching numbers and computerized linear thought, but the great discoveries come from the intuitive power of human beings. And to tap into that, we have to be more connected to our spiritual being.
I couldn't agree more. And I call that place for myself my knower, and my knower knows everything. And when I get quiet and listen to my knower, which is my higher self, my intuition, the answers come. And it's just, it never ceases to amaze me how that is. Yesterday I was driving on the freeway, and I was thinking how I was just going over some thoughts about, you know, there's a phrase, I think it goes like, and four makes egg roll. I was thinking of people and how many people it would take to create the perfect family, and I came up with 9 makes egg roll, and I thought it in my head, and I didn't say it out loud, and I thought, that's interesting, I didn't say it out loud. And then I look over to my right, and I see a car driving in front of me that says 6EGG666. So I thought, wow, that's just amazing that just occurred, because I was thinking what a silly thought to say out loud, and I didn't, and then a car drives by with the word egg on it, and I've never seen a license plate with the word egg on it until that moment. So I don't know if this fits into intuition or anything like that, or just plain old synchronicity, but I do believe it's all related.
Right. Well, synchronistic phenomena, what has been well described by Carl Jung, a famous psychiatrist, is really when we are in touch with that more intuitive part of ourselves, that events that we may just think are, they're just aligned aberrantly, really aren't. And it's somehow when we are aligned with that intuitive self, great things happen, or synchronistic types of things happen.
Mm-hmm.
In Celtic tradition in Ireland, They have a concept where they call certain places thin places, T-H-I-N, For example, the Cliffs of Moher, which are very much like our Big Sur area here in California, these wonderful places. And the idea is a thin place is where spirit and matter meets. When you go to those places, you feel this energy, you feel this power spot. And similarly, I think when athletes get in the zone and they're in that what I call timeless time, where time slows down and the ball or the baseball that goes so fast starts to get slower, it's almost as if spirit and matter meet. And I can remember an interview that Magic Johnson did, the famous Lakers guard. He would talk about that he could know where the guards were of the other team, where the opponents were, without even looking at them. He could feel their presence. So once again, it doesn't really fit into a scientific paradigm, but it's really speaking to this intuitive knowledge that human beings have the capacity to access when they have a higher consciousness.
Yes, and I see how spirituality is almost mandatory in sports to have an intuitive ability to beat the odds.
Well, I mean, there's a little clip on my website of Tiger Woods making a famous chip in the Masters a couple of years ago, and many people saw it, and it's a little chip shot that you could hit, you know, literally, even Tiger Woods could hit it a million times and not make it. But, of course, he made it at the most critical moment, in the most dramatic moment of sports, and he seems to do this time and time again. Now, there are many athletes out there that have great physical prowess and great physical gifts, but it's that special athlete that's able to tap into this other piece, maybe a spiritual piece or an intuitive piece, but it certainly has to do with their consciousness that allows them to really excel in those most critical moments. And that's a great example for all of us in our daily lives, whether that we're working as a salesperson or a hairdresser, when we're in the flow. And we studied this at UCSD. We not only studied elite athletes, but we studied, you know, regular folks like you and I. And sure enough, almost everybody in life, if asked to think about it, can speak of a time when they were doing something, giving a talk, and they were really on, and everything was just flowing very comfortably. And that, again, is another form of the zone. So really the book is about how each and every one of us can access, you know, this higher consciousness in our life and make our life more fulfilled.
So what I'm hearing you say is, and what I'm really getting in Technicolor right now, is for the world to aspire to raise consciousness would only make all of us better at everything that we do.
Absolutely.
So raising consciousness doesn't have to necessarily be a spiritual choice. I mean, even for people who are agnostic or atheists, raising consciousness would be a good thing for them to do to improve upon everything in their life, correct?
Well, yeah. I mean, we talked a little bit about fear, and I like to think about how faith kills fear, or faith always beats fear. And I talk about Lance Armstrong's struggle with cancer, and then after cancer, he went on to win the 7 Tour de France's. And his coach, Jim Okowitz, is a friend of mine, and I've spoken with him many times. And really, you know, Lance talked about, you know, how big a deal is the Tour de France after you had to face, you know, metastatic cancer throughout your body. And really the point is that if we have faith in our putter, in our bicycle, in Jesus, in Allah, Buddha, whatever, or nature, whatever our God is, it can be music, but then we learn to let go of our ego part of ourselves. And when we learn to do that, we really learn to access our true strength.
Right, right. And preparation is the key to overcoming and making room to express your greatness.
Well, I mean, preparation is when we're really well prepared. What happens is it brings our anxiety level down in competition. And why that works is because in competitive environments, whether it's sports or competing, in music or arts or business, you have to think on your feet in life. And if you're well prepared, much of the stuff you don't have to think about. It's sort of like it leaves, to use a computer analogy, it leaves room on the short-term RAM memory so you can run whatever program you need to do right then and there. I tell a story about Phil Mickelson winning the Masters, and I was there that year, and right before he teed off, he was taking a nap. And everybody thought that that was very unusual, that here he is sleeping and he's teeing off in 15 minutes in front of millions and millions of people watching. But the reason he was taking a nap is he said that he wanted to get refreshed and he was already fully prepared and he was relaxed and ready to go. Mm-hmm. Needless to say, he went out there and dominated and won that Masters.
Right, and that's very interesting to me. Either I'm just now having a deja vu with you, or I just heard that story yesterday by somebody else. That's a great story. And being a talent manager, and this is Spiritual Hollywood, and, you know, using Hollywood to raise consciousness is what this program is about, and also raising consciousness in general for to excel at anything, be it sports or acting or writing or producing or directing. Would you say that being prepared, like for the actor, for the director, producer, writer, being prepared is really one of the best allies that they could choose for themselves?
Well, it's among, you know, the top two. I like to say being prepared and fully committed. Now, most of my professional career has been involved with athletes in sports, but one thing comes to mind from the world of Hollywood, and that is an interview I once saw Denzel Washington give. And they asked him, you know, when he was young, before he was famous and successful, you know, what was your backup plan if acting didn't work out? And what I loved was his answer, which was, I didn't have a backup plan because I am an actor.
Mm.
And what I thought so powerful was that, you know, it was something that was so deep within him, that he was so committed to it, that there really was never any question. And so I think being fully prepared and fully committed sets the stage of higher consciousness or getting in the zone or peak performance in whatever domain of life.
I agree completely. I do know that when I was acting, I was an actor for 15 years before I became a talent manager and a talent agent. When I got my lines, I would learn them immediately and just have that done, just memorize everything, have it in me, and then forget about it until the day came for the audition or the time came for the audition, and then I would be unattached and just let it come forth as it wanted to come forth. And that way, whenever the director said, could you do it again but make this adjustment, I was then able to be flexible enough to make that adjustment without being dogmatic about my choices. So it's to be committed and prepared probably is what made that easy for me to do. Cold readings are what actors do, where they get the material just a few minutes or an hour or two before the reading, and then they go in and do it. That was one of my favorite things to do, is just hand me the pages and let me look at it once and go in and do it. So it took a lot of trusting myself, I think, to do that, and a lot of intuitive choices and just having fun, because for me to take that kind of a risk and not over prepare for me was fun. Now when it comes to sports, you do need to prepare and train and have a coach and be diligent about that, and for the book that you've written, Finding Your Zone, I believe that this book can help actors, this book can help anybody who wants to improve their game in life. And what I'm hearing you say is higher consciousness is the doorway to succeeding and excelling at everything. And what I'd like to address right now is, how is finding your zone like falling in love?
Well, that's fun to talk about, but let me just reinforce the point you just made, and that was, you know, the minute before or immediately before, in the case that you're talking, audition, mm-hmm. or with athletes in a competition, we try to encourage the athlete not to practice to the last moment.
Mm-hmm.
We try to encourage them really the night before or the morning before to just take it easy, and that the most important variable isn't to study to the last minute and do a crash course in whatever it is that you're going to be doing, but the most important variable is really getting in the right frame of mind, getting in the right kind of consciousness. And so, paradoxically, the day before a tournament, and I just got off the phone with one of the PGA Tour players before you,
mm-hmm.
the tournament start on Thursday, and he had a very good outing this last week, and he was asking about, you know, my thoughts about tomorrow, and Wednesday is another practice day, and I encouraged him not to practice too much, just to make sure you're fresh and relaxed and maybe see a nice movie.
Mm-hmm.
So come Thursday, you're really ready to go and be spontaneous. And I think that's the point you were making, and I really couldn't agree more, Kate. I think that's an excellent point.
Mm-hmm.
But now my favorite topic, falling in love.
Yes, mine too.
You know, I mean, falling in love, you know, in our youth, you know, it sort of dominates our spiritual psyche, if you will. But my thoughts about falling in love, it's certainly not something that you force. You know, you sort of, you know, set the environment, you set the stage, you're, you know, like people, when they're too desperate to fall in love, they really never do.
Mm.
When somebody finally gives up trying to find that perfect partner and then really starts to get in touch with themselves and they start to change their own energy, then sure enough, out of the blue, falling in love happens.
Right.
And in sports or getting in the zone, it's very similar, because if an athlete is always concerned with the result, oh, I have to win or I have to fall in love, right? Then it rarely comes.
Mm-hmm.
But when the person is able to turn their attention to the here and now and really get connected to the moment, that's when they fall into the zone and they do their best. And that's when people start to fall into love. And I see that in my clinical practice all the time, you know, treating patients alike. And the parallels are just uncanny.
Right. Well, thank you for that. And I can totally see how that happens, because I'm very much in love, and it all came from spending 2 years working on myself, falling in love with myself, so that I could be available for someone to fall in love with and to love them back. And I knew after a couple of marriages that I was bringing something from my side of the street to cause them not to be successful, and I wasn't about to do that again. So I prepared by learning to love myself, and by learning to be in the moment and be present, and learning to be authentic at all times, and learning to be willing to be myself and express myself authentically regardless of any consequences. And I knew that as long as I kept being who I am, someone would come along to appreciate it. And somebody did, and we're getting married on March 22nd.
Well, that is, you know, very exciting, and congratulations. And I'm sitting here smiling hearing you tell me that, because when we had that very nice lunch with that handsome young man who you were clearly in love with,
yes,
that was very exciting to see. And he's a heck of a nice guy, and,
yep.
and you are, and I'm very happy. But for both of you, and the point there is, you know, when people are in love, it's almost a dispositional quality. You know, you can see that someone's in love. They have this bounce to their step, this joie de vivre, this joy in life. And,
right.
And I think when we fall in love, it's as if the partner or through self-exploration, we find that more authentic self, that deeper part.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when those things open up. And love is another form of a doorway to spiritualism, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And so there really are many similarities. And again, Kate, I'm very happy for you.
Thank you.
John is just, he's a heck of a great guy, and you're both make a beautiful couple.
Thank you. And it was Valentine's Day when we had that lunch, so the hearts and birdies were swimming
right.
All around our heads.
Yeah, I smiled the whole way home.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, one thing that I've learned is that in every relationship you have in life, it really, really makes it sweeter when you can consciously amplify one another's best parts.
Well, that's, you know, and that's the great thing about putting your ego aside and, you know, being in touch with, you know, all your feelings and being able to share that. And that's not an easy thing to do. When psychiatrists and psychologists do couples therapy, I would say 80% of the work that we do in couples therapy is we ask the other partner to repeat back what their partner just told them. And uniformly in the beginning of that therapy, they never really hear what the other partner says. But through time, they learn to be more open, more receptive, more communicative, and that's when people really meet and really connect.
I can completely understand how that would happen, and it's just training the couple to be present with one another instead of trying to think of what they're going to say next, or trying to see how what they said pertains to them, or where's the hidden toxic message in what they just said, or something. What you're training them to do is just simply be present with one another and to see each other as human beings. And that's a wonderful thing. The way you just explained that makes complete and total sense. And I just want to share with our listeners one of the quotes in your book on page 121 in Finding Your Zone by Dr. Michael Lardon. It's a quote by Marianne Williamson, one of my favorites. It says, "Our deepest fear is not that we are inadequate. Our deepest fear is that we are powerful beyond measure. It is our light, not our darkness, that most frightens us." And I'd like you to expound on that just a bit, because this is epidemic where people really are, they don't even know that they don't know they're more frightened of their light than their darkness. They don't even know that they don't know that they're more afraid of their greatness than they are of their flaws. And I really believe that what a person thinks is most wrong with them is their gift, that's their gift in life. And to learn to accept that part of themselves would bring forth that light. What you chose this quote for your book for a reason, and I'd just like to hear your thoughts on that.
Sure. I mean, we live in a society of multimedia, and ironically, I'm speaking with you on your show, Spiritual Hollywood.
Mm-hmm.
And in our society, you know, it's people are very concerned about how they're perceived by others, and so that's really a fear-based thought. You know, what's going to happen? And really, what we want to teach people is to, you know, not worry about how you're perceived, not worry about the negative things that can happen, but to turn your focus inward and connect to yourself, and whatever fear you may have, whether it's a dream to be a pianist or to be an actor or to be whatever it might be, to embrace that and not worry about all the other things, because we only have this one life that we know of here on this planet, in this plane, and our job, if you will, is to fully embrace it and to enjoy it to the best of our ability. And unfortunately, I think the majority of people really make decisions based out of fear rather than based out of what they truly want and what they long for.
Mm-hmm.
And you see people that are exceptional and go on to do great things, you see that they go and do all the things that they want to do. And I had that thought when you were explaining about the ant and the Cheerio,
mm-hmm.
how, you know, you do five things a day. But what was really important about what you do is that all of those things are things that you really want to do. It's this world that you've created. And when we start to create our own world and our own destiny, we start to feel fulfilled.
Yes, and then love comes.
And then love comes.
Yeah, it's a wonderful thing. And then we're creating all these great things together now, and it's awesome. So I want to ask just what are the 5 points that a person can take home with them from this book? What are the 5 most practical points in this book, Finding Your Zone, that if you just were to say 5 most practical things that a person could utilize right now, what would that be?
Well, you know, there was an article or a review of my book a couple weeks ago in Golf Week, and the writer did, I think, a really good job, and he highlighted a few, so I'm going to sort of reiterate them back and expand.
Great.
And one of the first one I want to talk about is what I call instant amnesia.
Mm.
And I say that Tiger Woods has the greatest gift of instant amnesia, meaning if he hits a bad shot, he doesn't really worry about it, even though he goes to hit the next shot in front of thousands and thousands of people. It's as if he never hit a bad shot. And he's very unique in that way. And I remember giving an interview at the U.S. Open when it was here at Torrey Pines, and the sportscaster that was interviewing me, he said, maybe, Doc, that's what I should do when I have a bad day interviewing, you know, different athletes. And that's really a great lesson for anybody.
Mm-hmm.
You've gone out there and you've tried your best, you're not always going to succeed. We always like to say that failure is the mother of success, and sometimes success is the mother of failure, meaning if we get too big an ego. But if you're going to go out and engage yourself in life, some days you're going to have a great day and you're going to do well, and then some days you're not going to do as well. But if you tried your best and you gave it your all, you leave it, and you don't worry about it again, and then you go out and do it again. And we call that ability of instant amnesia a wonderful way to not contaminate the next thing you do and to just take that energy forth. So that's the first concept that this writer talked about.
Right, and if I could just, if I'd just like to interject something that I feel so driven to say that our listeners may relate to. So what you just said, instant amnesia, could be translated like this. Dance like nobody's watching, love like you've never been hurt, and do your radio show as if nobody's listening.
You know what? That's exactly right.
Yeah.
I mean, and that's so right. And it's like, you know, even to take the example of doing this radio show, I've done a lot of interviews in my life, but like every human being, I get a little nervous, you know, when I'm being interviewed like anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
But once we get into the interview and I enjoy your company,
mm-hmm.
Then we're talking, you know, I'm talking to you as if nobody's listening.
Yes.
And that's that same kind of theme. So,
yes.
So I just highlight that and I say absolutely. And really these concepts, I didn't make them up. I just had the fortune to be helping great athletes throughout my life. I mean, Eric Heiden, who won 5 gold medals in the 1980 Olympics, he was my lab partner in college. And so all this synchronicity happened in my life. And these are the kinds of traits that I've seen in these types of athletes over and over again. And so writing the book, believe it or not, how I did it was I wrote a chapter in someone else's book, and the publisher said, you know, Dr. Lardon, why don't you write your own book? And I said, I'm not a very good writer.
Mm.
I said, dictate it. And I dictated the whole book on Memorial Weekend a year ago, and I just sat down and kind of went through all my notes, and it just sort of organically came out, and I wasn't self-conscious. Now, I admit they rewrote it many times to get the grammar correct. But so that's how that went. So that's instant amnesia.
Wonderful.
I think another concept that's really helpful is to learn to be what we call process-oriented rather than result-oriented.
Mm-hmm.
It means, you know, if a golfer says to me, hey, Doc, I have to win the U.S. Open, I'll say, well, what do you have to do to win the U.S. Open? And they'll say, well, I have to make, you know, a lot of birdies, many more birdies than bogeys. And then I'll say, how do you make more birdies? And then they'll say, well, you know, I have to hit very good shots. And then I'll say, well, how do you hit very good shots? And ultimately, I'll come back to being committed and prepared.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we teach people is to not worry so much about some future event that might happen,
mm-hmm.
not worry about something in the past, but if they invest their energy at the task at hand, it will result in the result that they're hoping for.
Mm-hmm.
And another interesting way to conceptualize anxiety is to think of anxiety as the gap between the here and now and the future and the here and now and the past.
Mm.
For example, if I worry about right now when I'm talking to you, oh gosh, I'm not going to do well on this telephone interview, I suddenly get some anxiety.
Yeah.
Or if I think, oh, 3 weeks ago when I did an interview, I didn't do my best, I'll get anxiety. But
mm-hmm.
if I just stay with you and listen to you
mm-hmm.
and let my thoughts come through,
mm-hmm.
then there is very little anxiety, and I do my best. And that's called being process-oriented
mm-hmm.
rather than being always result-oriented.
Right, and you're just letting your stream of consciousness flow because there isn't any anxiety, and anxiety will squash creativity, and squash creativity won't allow stream of consciousness. So it's vital to not become self-conscious, and I think self-consciousness in acting is also what kills a scene. It's a death of an audition.
Right, and in sports, in almost all competitive things, so we promote self-awareness,
yes,
but we try to make sure that we're not self-conscious.
Yes.
So that's exactly right, and if you look at the most successful people, you know, take Bill Gates, one of the richest people in the world,
mm-hmm.
his goal was never to make money.
Mm-hmm.
His goal was, you know, really he was a computer nerd who, in fact, dropped out of Harvard after his freshman year.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really about following your heart and
mm-hmm.
Rather than thinking, oh, I have to live in this mansion or I have to drive a Lamborghini.
Mm-hmm.
Really do what you love, then you're rich. And I always like to say when myself as a psychiatrist has to consult in the intensive care unit when someone is at the end of their life,
right,
we might find people with great material wealth, but there's really no one visiting them.
Aww.
We might find a family that doesn't have great material wealth, but they have the grandchildren and the great-grandchildren.
Mm-hmm.
Very quickly, in that moment, with those two juxtaposed scenes,
mm-hmm.
you really learn what real wealth is.
Yes,
and it's
absolutely.
A very insightful experience.
Yes, and Dr. Michael Beckwith has created a new CD that's electronica music that John and I jump around to all the time, and his lyrics are, why not just give in and be happy? Why not just give in and be great? Why not give in and be prosperous? Why not give in? And it's just a matter of giving in, isn't it?
Yeah, well, it's a matter of letting go of that ego that holds us and doing what we enjoy. And it's almost as if we have the compass within us and we sort of create these magnetic fields that take us off course.
Right, because our natural flow is abundance.
Right, exactly. I mean, God and nature really built us as beautiful creatures.
Yes.
And it's about embracing that.
Yes, and allowing it. There's an art to allowing that.
There's a real art to it, and
yes.
That's what the book is really about. It's
right.
About the art of higher consciousness, the
mm-hmm.
art of getting in touch with yourself.
And applying it to all things.
Right, exactly.
And to yourself mostly.
Uh-huh.
Because if we don't apply that to ourselves, then we are not walking around being authentic people who love ourselves. I mean, until you love yourself, you really can't let anyone love you or love anyone back. You really must start with yourself. And that's where, you know, it's like another thing that Dr. Michael Beckwith said at Agape Service recently was, he said, you know, how many relationships do you have to go through before you realize that you're dating yourself? And it really starts with yourself. And I think this book could help people really figure out who they are and how they're stopping themselves and how to learn to allow greatness to come through them, because that's who they are. And you really have to pinch that off like a hose, you know, that's all bound up and the water won't come out. But when you unbind it, the water flows freely. We have to really work hard to bind ourselves up like that, because the natural flow of our life is abundance and joy, happiness and love. And that really might sound cliche, and it happens to be true. That is really what we are as source energy, and everything is energy. So, you know, to start with the self really, really is the important thing, or you cannot access your greatness and you cannot access the flow or the zone. And that's just my opinion.
Well, no, I couldn't agree with you more. And I mean, I don't know if we probably won't have time, but at least it'll get me to my third point, and that is the first chapter in the book, and
uh-huh.
It's called Dream.
Right.
And the idea of dream is that, and it can be a dream at night or a daydream or just a walk and a meditative experience, but the idea is to connect yourself with your unconscious.
Yes.
And I always like to say, you know, we're the noisiest passenger of our own ship.
Yep.
And we spend a third of our lives sleeping in this dream state that helps metabolize all the stresses of the day. And if we can learn to really connect with our deeper selves, that's when we really learn what we want to do and what is you know, maybe what partner really makes sense. And we get answers to questions that we can't solve through analytic thinking.
Right, exactly right. And we've come up to the last bit of the Spiritual Hollywood Hour, and I promised you, Michael, that this would be a very fast hour, and I just want to leave our listeners with your website again, www.drlardon.com, that's drlardon.com. Please check out his website, and please check out his book, Finding Your Zone. You will be so happy that you did. And who would have thunk that sports would be the gateway to spirituality, and spirituality is the gateway to sports? I mean, higher consciousness is really what it's all about. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Thank you, Dr. Lardon, for being my guest tonight. It was a blast. And just remember to stand up really tall and take a deep breath and love yourselves. Remember, the last six letters of attraction are action, so create the life that you can love. And we'll see you next week. Thanks again.
Kate, thanks. It was a blast.
Okay, good night.